Hello and welcome to another episode of Sons of Ignatius podcast. My name is Father Niall Leahy. I am a priest in Gardiner Street Parish in Dublin, Ireland. And I am joined this week by a Jesuit priest friend, Father Michael Simoni. Father Michael, how do you do?
How are you doing? I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been talking about this for a little while now.
True.
Getting you on the pod.
True.
And here we are. I'm happy to get you on the podcast, Michael, because this is keeping our nice kind of Irish-American both sides of the Atlantic thing going. And you truly are a Jesuit with transatlantic experience.
Yes, at this point, yeah, for sure.
Why don't you tell the listeners how we met?
So in September of 21, I moved to Dublin from Boston, Massachusetts to participate in a level of Jesuit formation called Tertianship.
Tertianship. I'm smelling some Jesuit lingo.
Yes. So usually 5 to 15 years after a Jesuit becomes a priest, he's sent somewhere, usually outside of his home country, for about 9 months to a year of prayer and contemplation and learning about the Jesuits, studying our constitutions, studying our spirituality, doing the 30-day spiritual exercises another time, probably the first time since the novitiate, and then doing some kind of direct service to the poor. So there are, I think, 9 English-speaking tertianships throughout the world. Right. And after looking at a number of them, I loved the one in Dublin. And even better, there was space for me at the one in Dublin, because you have to get a space. And so it all worked out. And I moved there in September of 21 to spend about 9 months doing tertianship in Dublin.
So is it fair to say that it's almost like a second novitiate?
It is. Like, and that's why it's called tertianship, is it's our third year of novitiate.
Right.
So we do 2 years of novitiate at the beginning, as you know. And then we do a third year somewhere down. So most guys do it within 5 years of ordination. I was working as a university professor, and because of the constraints of getting a PhD and then getting tenure and publishing and whatever, I actually was delayed in tertianship. But it was a full 15 years after ordination.
Wow. You were too busy.
I was. Let's go with that.
Understand.
Distracted might be better.
Yeah. You were teaching in Boston College.
I was. My background is in archaeology, but there's less of a need for that than you might think. So I was teaching Old Testament and dead languages.
Old Testament and dead languages, not deadly languages. Dead languages.
I mean, you can use Coptic for curses. We studied a lot of Coptic curses in my classes.
What? Oh, okay, we're getting off track here already, but what defines a dead language?
A language that no longer has a community of speakers currently. So, for example, Aramaic is a living language. There are still, I mean, before the war, at least in Syria, there were a number of villages where a modern version of Aramaic was spoken. So Aramaic technically would be a living language. Whereas Coptic hasn't been spoken outside of ecclesiastical use since the 1700s.
So if Latin is used solely in ecclesiastical use, does that mean it is a live or a dead language?
Your instinct is good. There's a debate about whether or not Latin is alive or dead, because it does actually get daily use in some corners of the Vatican. And as long as you're still coming up with new words for new experiences, new words for new realities, as long as you're finding creative new ways to apply the language to daily life, it's still considered a living language.
And as long as Harry Potter has been translated into that language, surely that counts.
A good example of that. Whereas, like, a language that is truly dead is ancient Hittite. This is a language that has not been spoken probably since the end of the second millennium BC.
Okay.
Right. And yeah. But you know, we use now because there are a lot of religious texts that were written in the language that bear resemblance to scriptural texts, and so give us some context, especially in the Psalms, for what's going on in the Psalms. So this is why one studies Hittite, among other things.
Wow. Yeah, that's the thing.
This is not where I thought this conversation would go.
But I mean, it's something that I think that's really underestimated when you talk to a scripture scholar, to realize just how much many ancient languages they had to master before they could even begin to understand the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good for you, Michael.
Language is something for us. That comes to me. I won't say it comes easily, but it comes to me, and I managed to put that to work. Yeah.
And so you came to Garden Street Parish then offering to say masses here. On the weekend.
Yes. So I think it was early on in my time in Ireland, maybe by the end of October, Frank Janine, the president of the conference, had come through just to greet us all and get to know us. And one of his obsessions, as I'm sure you know, is vocation promotion. And he said, anything you can do to help the Irish province promote vocations, please do while you're here. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Charlie Davey and I got your contact information as vocation promoter and got in touch with you. And then also with the idea that I would help out at Gardner Street on Sundays, because we were also encouraged to find some kind of Sunday mass call while we were there.
And you rocked up here on Sundays, and instantly I really liked your, let's say, attention to the liturgy. I liked your sense of humor with the congregation, which was very warmly received, and including making fun of yourself, which self-deprecation always goes down well in Ireland.
I discovered that, yeah.
Especially when the priest laughs at himself.
Yeah, there's no limit to the appreciation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes me wonder, makes me wonder a lot of things about priests in Ireland, but we'll leave that for another conversation.
And also, the fact that you were a scripture scholar meant you had great insight into the scriptures and you were able to open the word to people in a wonderful way. So your presence here for the few months that you were working in the church was greatly appreciated.
Well, I'm grateful to hear that. I loved every minute of my time there and looking forward to coming back.
So that was the reason, really, I was keen for you to come on to the podcast, Michael, was to hear your impressions of the Irish church. That coming from outside and being here for 9 months, I think often like a newcomer's impression reveals a lot. So, what did you think of our little old Catholic church here in Ireland?
I was very impressed with it. I know that that's not the default setting for most people these days, but I was very impressed with it.
Well, let's leave it there. Another great episode.
It was a great talk.
This is, Church Triumphant here. Report.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
From Ireland. Did you just say that you found it very impressive?
I did. Yes. Wow. Yeah. I will. And I'm going to back it up in ways that I'm certain all Irish people are going to be like, oh, he just doesn't understand. Right. So I'm willing to go to the mat for my misunderstanding.
God bless him. It's just rose tinted glasses. Yeah.
So can I give a little context first?
Yes, please do.
I'm from the United States. And even though I'm from very Catholic parts of the United States, I am from a Protestant country and have felt that all my life. So, I mean, Catholicism here, even in the Catholic heartland of like Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Chicago, is a minority faith. And so like things like holy days of obligation, if you tell your boss, I need some time off to go to mass on the Feast of the Assumption, you know, 9 times out of 10, your boss isn't going to understand. In fact, you're best off with a Jewish boss who himself will have a tradition of having to go on the high holy days and things and understands these religious obligations. If you're working at a company and they don't understand those kind of things, you get no leeway whatsoever.
Okay, here's a litmus test for whether you live in a Catholic country or not. Do people look at you strange when you have a black mark on your forehead on Ash Wednesday?
Weirdly, less so now than 20 years ago. Getting ashes on Ash Wednesday has become like, it's gone native in the culture here. We get a lot of non-Catholics who want ashes and who are welcome to take them. And then suddenly all the Protestant, all the liturgical Protestant churches, like the Lutherans and the Episcopalians, they're all giving out ashes too. Even my Unitarian friends who believe in at most one God want to do ashes on Ash Wednesday, right?
Wait, hang on a second. We believe in one God as well, don't we?
But they believe in at most one God.
Oh, possibly fewer than one God.
Possibly, yes. Right, okay. A number less than one.
Moving swiftly on. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, this podcast just started violating FCC regulations. Anyways, so yeah, but that being said, certainly when I was younger, certainly when I was in college, you know, going to work with ash on my forehead, the first thing people would say is, you better wash your face, right? You know, like,
right. And in Ireland, yeah, it's, it must be Ash Wednesday.
Yeah, everybody yeah. gets it. Everybody gets it.
Oh no, it's the beginning of Lent.
So I'm from a Protestant country. My family's Italian, and I know the culture in Italy, I'd say, well enough. And in Italy, the church is treated like a public utility. It's like the water company or the electric company, right? Like, it's, you don't necessarily have, it's just kind of taken for granted. It's no one really gets too excited about it one way or another, right?
The government's Department of Grace.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's even more like weather systems, right? Like, oh, the Pope died. We're going to have a conclave, right? Like, right. Like, I remember my father may or may not believe in God, but the Pope is infallible, darn it. And don't you ever question that. Right?
Oh, tell us someone about your aunt.
Oh, Jehovah's Witnesses came to her door.
Yeah, I love this story. Yeah.
Jehovah's Witnesses came to her door and asked her if she wanted to hear more about their religious tradition. And she looked at them and said, I don't even believe in the true faith. Why would I believe in this?
died into old Catholic. Just.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but can't, atheist, yeah.
Can't, but atheist, can't, just can't shake it off, yeah.
I had never been in a country and a culture where the piety was so thick and the Catholicism so widespread. So, like, in Italy, the piety is kind of an inch deep and a mile wide, right? Like, nobody gets too worked up about these things. And in the United States, the piety is deeper, but it's a choice, right? Because we're islands of piety, basically. Mm. But in Ireland, it's like everyone has feelings about the church. Everyone has feelings about Catholicism. Everyone has, even people who don't go to church have feelings about all of this stuff. Like, there's an interiority to it that I found really fascinating. And actually, I wish I could find a word that didn't sound condescending. I found it deeply touching. People who clearly are on the outs with the church and may never come back to go to mass, when they found out I was a priest, like, had really strong things to say about their faith, about God's action in their life, about their disappointment with X, Y, and Z. And I remember thinking, this is new to me, this level of, like, continued engagement and powerful engagement. And yet at the same time, like, clearly some problems. Mm-hmm. But beneath all that, a level of commitment that blew my mind. And then I got to add this. Every day at 6 p.m., you have the Angelus on television.
Of course. Doesn't every country have the Angelus?
I watched it every day that I could just because it was such a thing, right? Yeah. Like, 70% of the people in Ireland want to maintain it, including like something like 65% of the people under the age of 18, right? Like, it's even popular among the youth. Now, I'm sure you can talk me out of my astonishment at that, but.
Yeah. Well, I have a funny story about that.
All right, please.
This is 20 years ago, I would say. I was listening to a late night radio chat show that's very popular here in Dublin. And a prominent Muslim man had proposed that the Angelus no longer be broadcast on television or radio because Ireland should be a more secular country or something like that. And we shouldn't be promoting one religion.
Right.
And so anyway, there was a phone in and some kind of poll about whether it should be kept or not. And it was overwhelmingly in favor of keeping the Angelus, not because people want to pray it, but just that it gives a sense of us as Irish people. And no one's going to come into our country and tell us what we or will not broadcast on our, you know, on our national television station. So yeah, it is one of the, I mean, is it a vestige of an older Ireland and just our sense of nostalgia? Just, we can't bring ourselves to get rid of it. Or is it something living and living part of our culture? I guess a little bit of A and a little bit of B.
Yeah. So that's where I didn't spend enough time. I was only there for 9 months. I didn't spend enough time to sort out the question you just raised. What of it is like living active faith and a response to a living active faith? And what of it is a cultural institution, maybe even a cultural relic? I think that's a question a lot of Irish people ask about these things that I just didn't have the time or the sophistication to answer. Because to me, it looks like everyone's really engaged.
Right.
And it's, and I, you know, I keep hearing people say, well, that's not the case. I suspect too that like starting 1922, is that when the Civil War ended?
Sure.
So 1922, maybe to 1992, there's a period of what is that, 70 years of like where the civil society was the church, probably in a lot of ways. Or at least the civil society was Catholic culture in a lot of ways.
And there are certainly, I think, a lot of people who have ceased attending church, but who do keep a lot of the sensibilities and will want to get their children baptized, for example. You know, like, whereas in most countries, you would think, God, if you've walked away from church, why in God's name would you want to have your children
Done.
baptized?
Yeah,
You know,
right.
because it's not as if Catholic schools are oversubscribed. You're going to get in anyway. I mean, for example, in our primary school here in Gardiner Street, in the north inner city of Dublin, I think about, I'd say, one third of the children are now Catholic,
Okay.
and they will be preparing for the sacraments. So, you know, it's clear that our schools are open to
Yeah.
non-Catholics. So,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
but yeah, there is still a thing about getting your kids baptized.
Where I also saw something like that. So I attended 12-step fellowship for recovery, and I attended a lot of meetings while I was in Dublin. And I would often hear people talk about when they were re-engaging or discovering spirituality for the first time. They would talk about finding a priest to talk to, or finding a religious person to talk to, or going to church, or making a retreat, or like their initial response to that movement was to do something Catholic. And contrast that with the United States, where the initial response to that movement is almost always non-institutional religion. So usually Buddhism,
Okay.
which in the US is kind of like the it's fast becoming like the popular culture religion. Not any kind of Buddhism that anyone in Thailand would recognize, right? But
Okay.
like the
Okay.
American version of it. Whereas in Ireland, there's still this sense
Buddhism
of like,
from the mind body spirit section of the bookshop.
exactly.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Whereas in Ireland, like spirituality still means something Catholic. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest or even awareness that there would be other options. And when I suggested that to a couple of friends, I suggested Pema Chodron. She writes all sorts of books for people in recovery and coming out of a Buddhist background. But I mean, it's just kind of like generic humanistic advice. They were completely uninterested. I mean, it like they, why would I choose that when I don't
Yeah.
even believe in the true faith?
Okay, well, just to, I suppose, give the other side of the coin a little bit, Michael, I wonder, your visit here to Ireland was at a very particular time when I would say we are just coming to the end of, let's say, the first wave of kind of post-Catholic Ireland and post-Catholic society, where we still have many of, let's say, the vestiges. So, for example, there are still a large number of priests here. They're old for the most part, so they're 70, 80, 90. There's still a large number of churches here, so church buildings are still visible.
There are a lot of dioceses there. You have as
They're like,
many, you have 26 dioceses for the same number of people in the single diocese of Los Angeles.
If anyone, you know, needs a diocese, like, we have a few going spare
Oh, I'll take Rafo. I'll
here.
take Rafo in a heartbeat.
We have, they're 10 a penny
That
here.
place is beautiful.
We have like the, I think it's 26 dioceses, and we also have, well, what's, you'll be able to tell me, like, they're kind of like paradioses or whatever, or they're, you know, when a titular diocese, when your titular
Oh,
bishop
yes.
needs a kind of a small patch of
Yeah.
land to be his diocese, he often gets like an island that's on the River Shannon or something.
That's awesome.
So we have some of those.
I
They're
want
like, you know, it's like when you buy a company from the shelf or something, you know,
that.
we've got dioceses that are,
I don't think I've felt this level of cupidity in a long time. I want one of those islands.
No, but the catch is you can't actually go there. You can never go there because they're a diocese, like within a diocese. Anyway, this is, I'll get a canon lawyer on sometime to go through that. Yeah.
Bishop of Innistriacht or something. Magic Island.
Magic Island. Yeah. So, point I was trying to make was that maybe we're just coming to the end of this first wave of post-Catholic Ireland, where Catholicism is no longer mainstream and mm-hmm. something a bit more fringe, or let's say practicing Catholicism is something that's a bit more fringe now. And I think the crucial point is that this, let's say, weaker form of Catholic, let's say, nostalgia, or, you know, this Catholic sensibility that remains, although it's powerful and it is very real, I wonder, is it strong enough or alive enough to kind of reproduce itself?
Right.
So, you know, having, you know, all the church buildings and the aging priests and all that is certainly enough to keep people in touch in some way spiritually, but is it enough to create Christians who will tell other people about Christ, or who will really take it on and run with it? And that's, I don't think it will. I don't think it will. And I think to have a church that knows that it will reproduce into the future and will grow, yeah, I think we need a more vibrant experience of faith than we have in Ireland at the moment.
So I would agree with you to this extent. The historical moment of, and again, I just choose these dates randomly, but like, again, 22 to 92, because the Celtic Tiger starts up in the early 90s, right?
It does. Yep.
And that's usually, like, people would identify that as kind of the end of traditional Ireland and beginning of something new.
Yeah. And okay. that was the economic boom that.
Okay. So that 22 was, to 92, that, which was a very powerfully self-replicating form of Catholicism in that era, I think you're correct. That is done. And, you know, like, we have this problem in the United States too. We have the institutional hangover of that period. So we have all these church buildings that are maybe a quarter full on Sundays that were designed for vastly more people and a vastly younger crowd that simply no longer exist. And we have, yeah. And I think in this case, the US might be 20 to 30 years ahead of Ireland in this sense that, like, that generation of 70, 80, 90 year old priests is what we had back in the 90s. Guys who were ordained in the 40s, mostly 40s and 50s. So the question then becomes the energy that's there. And I felt a very powerful energy in the church and in Catholicism while I was there. The energy that's there, will the Holy Spirit show us how to ride that wave? Like, there was a way to ride that wave with schools and parishes and Legion of Mary and the whole bit. And that's over now. Like, what's the new surfboard? Okay. That's a terrible example, but you know what I mean? Like,
okay.
And I think, so to what you say, yeah, if we don't ask that question and receive the answer, I think that wave is just going to crest and move on and nothing's going to come of it. But I think if people like yourself and other younger leaders of the church can recognize how to speak to the hunger and the energy that's there in a way that presents Catholicism as something not just reasonable, but like a healthy part of an adult life, I think a new form of Catholicism will arise.
And one that people can embrace wholeheartedly and really value.
I think so, yeah. My knowledge of Irish history is, like, mostly cribbed from Wikipedia and National Geographic, but it does strike me that the church has been worse off in Ireland historically than it is currently. I mean, there were periods when it was illegal to be Catholic, right?
Right, right.
Of course. Most Irish people will tell me, well, that's when we were the best.
Right? Oh, bring back the good old days when it was illegal. Yeah. Now it's just irrelevant.
Spites for the landlord. Well, then it all made sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It strikes me that there's a new energy there, and it's going to be a matter of learning how to accompany that in the lives of the people that we serve. I say we, but you, really.
Yeah. Well, we've plans to bring you back here, Michael.
Yes, I'm coming. I'm coming back next spring. Yeah,
next year, that'd be great. Okay, so that's okay. I'm glad we talked about that. It is good to sort of end on a message of hope there. That okay, something is certainly waning here, but maybe that is a springboard or something. From we're not starting from zero. put up
no
with that.
Right. Yes.
We're not starting from zero. There's a lot in the culture that we can work with. That is definitely a positive note. I'm also interested to hear your thoughts, Michael, on how, let's say, Irish Catholicism differs from American Catholicism. And maybe, you know, I should qualify that or nuance that more by saying American Catholicisms, because there are various expressions of the church in America, each with their own flavor. How does the Irish Catholic scene sort of differ or compare to those?
And I got a double dose of the Italian-American version of Catholicism too, which itself is a little strange by American standards.
Right.
Not every parish has street processions with saint statues four times every summer.
But mine did. Every summer. Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, there's St. Anthony and Our Lady of Mount Carmel and Our Lady on the 15th. And then St. Gregory, because we were St. Gregory's parish. So on September 3rd.
It's amazing how Catholic culture expresses itself in warm countries.
Yes. Yeah.
All these outdoor activities.
Yeah. Well, so I remember hearing from, and he was Irish born, but growing up in the United States, an Irish American priest who said that when he first encountered that kind of culture from, and it was Italians and Portuguese that he knew, he was utterly scandalized. Because, you know, here are these like little kids pinning dollar bills on Mary's robes and people like eating street food at the same time, processing in a religious procession. And he just was not prepared for that at all. But yeah, you're right. This is the Italian.
Is this church or is this carnival? Like what's going on here? Yeah.
And in my mind, there's not a whole lot of difference between the two. But that's not standard American.
Scandalous.
Mythology.
Scandalous.
Yes, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I think this would be the biggest, if I were to isolate one thing, because of our individualism in the United States, and I probably because of our commitment to capitalism, religious adherence is a choice you make. And the choice comes first, right? Like if you're an adult and you're still a practicing Catholic, it's not because you were born into a Catholic family, but because it's somewhere along the line you decided you were going to keep coming to church. And you can usually identify that moment. It struck me in Ireland that Catholicism was more a matter of participating in the culture. And there were often choices, and people could also identify the moment when they really took on their Catholicism in a real way. So that's, it's not that that's not there, but it does strike me as that there was something first, a cultural connection first, that I would never have felt in the United States. And I think that changes the feel of what you're doing when you go to Mass. Because especially like, I didn't get too much time in the countryside, but I did visit the Bishop of Raphoe and went to Mass at some tiny little church where it was all in Irish anyway, so I had no idea what was going on. But it felt more like a gathering of a local civic organization. Now, again, right. I couldn't hear what they were saying, so there was probably a lot of beautiful piety, but these were neighbors coming together to hang around with their neighbors. And so the Catholicism there, and I suspect this is this way elsewhere in Ireland, is marked by this sense of a like community building and community organizing and and like paying attention to like who's not here today and is she all right and oh he emigrated or whatever. And that stuff would happen in the United States too, but before that there would be this performance of my choice of going to church in the US. I don't know, does that make sense?
Do you know what? Like I really feel that reality when I'm preaching in the church here. Because who are you preaching to? Are you preaching to people who maybe don't know each other so well, but who all believe the same, who have the same set of beliefs? Or are you talking to people who know each other quite well and aren't quite sure what they believe? And, you know, how does that affect the preaching? Well, you know, if you're talking to the first, well, then the onus is on you is to speak about the beliefs. And to like, you know, whatever, today's the solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. And we believe that, you know, and I can just elaborating on the beliefs and this is what brings us together. So let's talk about that. Or would you say, I was talking to so-and-so during the week and they told me that their son is unwell and we're all going to pray for him now and blah, you know, and it's about the fabric. You got to talk about the fabric of the lived fabric of the community. In Dublin at the moment, in this part of Dublin, we have both. We have people who have lived here all their lives and they're just absolutely part and parcel and caught up in the life of this place. And then you have people who are newly arrived and for whom the traditions and customs and stories of this place don't mean so much. So it is hard. But you know what? Like one time when I really saw the second, you know, the kind of the community aspect of the church really coming to the fore was during COVID. I stayed in Clongowes for a number of months during the lockdown, which is our boarding school in County Kildare. Mm. And I tuned into the local mass, which was on the webcam. The priest there would, like, the whole service was kind of interspersed with little bits of news from people he had been speaking to, etc. Because everyone was locked up in their homes. The church just became, it was one part mass, one part local radio.
And yeah.
It was golden. It was absolutely golden. Like, people were just so hungry for those human connections.
I think that illustrates it beautifully.
There are polls now in the church now. It's like, okay, are we people who don't know each other so well, but we all believe the same thing? Or do we know each other really well? And the question of what we believe is kind of secondary. The priest ought to know what we believe. we don't care so much, you know.
I think growing out of that too is the second most striking thing that I saw in Ireland, and contrasting very strongly with the United States. At every level and at every point in the political spectrum among Catholics, the commitment to the works of mercy, and especially the commitment to care for the poor, both at home and abroad, is so much stronger in Ireland than it is in the United States.
Really?
It's so much stronger in Ireland. Yeah, that was something that kind of stunned me. So, I mean, in the United States, we have kind of a negative attitude toward poor people in general. I think if you're poor in the United States, the assumption is you did something wrong to get you there. Okay. And, you know, there's a whole history of that. And there's a whole mythology of that I wish we had time to go into, but we really don't. But you're poor because of your bad choices is the assumption in the U.S. Irish people do not assume that. If you're poor in Ireland, the benefit of the doubt falls on the side of somebody did something to you, and that's why you're in this situation.
Okay.
Irish people in general, in my experience, are much quicker to lend a hand and to want to lend a hand. And the church is much more institutionally active in lending a hand. Mm-hmm. Now, I won't deny, my work in Ireland also took me to a homeless shelter run by the Legion of Mary, which I think is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen the Roman Catholic Church do. So I'm a little biased in this regard. Okay. But
tell us about that. What do the Legion of Mary do?
So the Legion of Mary, they're parish organizations all throughout Ireland, but they also invest very much in outreach to the poor, direct service to the poor. In Dublin, they run a homeless shelter it's Smithfield or Grange Gorman. I never learned where that boundary was. It has about 70
Dublin,
beds.
Dublin 7, somewhere over there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, because the other thing I never learned with the zip codes. Yeah, it has about 70 beds. There are some long-term residents. There are some very short-term residents. They serve two meals a day. They have a men's shed program in the afternoons to provide skills to people who have been chronically unemployed, chronically homeless. In some cases, people who missed out on opportunities for education because of drug addiction or poverty. It's an all-around program run completely by volunteers. And there are six members of the Legion who live there in the shelter with the men. And then there were two of us Jesuits who lived there with the volunteers. Again, I never felt so authentically Christian as I did when I worked there.
Wow.
You know, I'd be peeling potatoes and mopping floors and saying mass and hearing confessions all in the same morning. And
you rolled up your sleeves.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And no one thought that the work being done there was extraordinary. Like, this is the work of the church. And when I went elsewhere in Ireland, it didn't matter where I went. It didn't matter how big or how small the church was. There were obvious, visible signs that the poor were being cared for by that parish community. And this is in a European country that has a social safety net. I mean, like, one could make the case that this work doesn't need to be done as it may have had to have been done in the 1920s, right? And yet the emphasis is so, so strong on this. And it's not because of somebody's commitment to a liberal form of Catholicism or a conservative form or nostalgia or anything. It's just like, this is what we do. And I learned this statistic after I came back to the United States. When there is a famine anywhere in the world, the Irish give proportionately more than anyone else by nation. And the assumption is it's because that, you know, the memory of hard times, even though it's a century and a half ago, almost two centuries ago now, is still strong in the culture that people respond like, of course we're going to do this.
Yeah.
And that was very striking to me, and made me long for that kind of same spirit here in the United States. Now, this will take a century to implant, but like, it made me realize what we lack here in a way that made me very excited to try to engage that. So I would add that.
Wow, that's powerful. And there was, from our conversations here as well, I definitely got the impression that the men living in the boarding house were men of deep faith as well.
Many of them, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, who had fallen on hard times.
Yeah.
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 What you're saying there about the Irish, sort of the general level of compassion that we have for the poor, reminds me of another, let's say, vestige, which is very much, I kind of suppose, alive, is this Society of the St. Vincent de Paul, which is a Catholic charity that cares for the poor. And I'd say in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, the Vincent de Paul has just exploded in universities, Irish universities.
Really?
You know, there are all sorts
of
student societies and groups that you can belong to. If you did this sport or that sport or debating or history or whatever. But the St. Vincent de Paul is one of the largest societies now in both University College Dublin and Trinity College Dublin, as far as I'm aware. And lots and lots of young people signing up. So there's a sense that the church and the Catholic ethos is still very authentically on the side of the poor, and there's nothing affected about it.
Right. Right. Yeah. You're not performing for the cameras. Yeah. This is a genuine expression of your faith.
Yeah. Very good. So when you were here, Michael, as well, you also decided not to return to academia.
Yes.
You came over here as a scripture scholar and you returned as a pastor.
Parish priest. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And, and was your experience in Ireland part of that?
Yeah, definitely was. I loved my work. So I just want to state, I loved Boston College. I had a lot of fun there. But it never came to feel natural. I never expected it to feel easy, but I wanted it to, at some point, to feel like I'd landed, like that this was my career, this was my mission from the Society of Jesus, and that the work was going to start to just kind of flow. And it never did. I got a book out and it got a good review, which is what you need for a tenured position at an American university. I had several articles. I had some book chapters. I mean, I had done the publications, but they had come out slowly. Some of that was my own doing. It took me a long time to get things done. Some of that was because of the pandemic. And because of the slow nature of that, when my time came to apply for tenure, I didn't have enough work out to make a very powerful case to get tenure. And my dean said, he was using an American baseball metaphor, when somebody's up for tenure, I want it to be a home run. In your case, it might be a ground out at first. Okay. So like he wasn't sure that I would get it, in other words.
Okay.
And so he invited me to stay on at BC, but to stay on as an adjunct faculty member, which is basically I'd be a contractor and not a partner. And I did that for a couple of years and I thought, I just feel like this isn't it. So I talked to my provincial before I left for Ireland. And he said, well, you're doing this year of discernment. He said, as part of the discernment, let's talk about where you're going to go after Ireland. He said, you go back to BC or we can find something new for you to do. And I made the spiritual exercises and made a good election and felt a lot of freedom about not returning to BC. Although if he had wanted me to go back there, I would have done it. If my provincial had wanted me to go back. But then I went to work for the Legion of Mary at the Morningstar Hospice, or Hostel, rather, the Morningstar Hostel. And I thought, oh, I want to do this. Like, suddenly there was no question. I wanted to do something, wanted direct service to people. And I wanted something a little more like primary Christian outreach. Teaching the Old Testament is wonderful, but there's no reason to take a vow of chastity to do that kind of work. So
I find myself having this conversation with Jesuits quite a bit that has, let's say, the intellectual mission of the church been compromised in some way by the demands of, let's say, professional academia. You know, that you really have to be churning out article after article.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the same way that let's say, academics in other fields, whether it be science or the humanities, have to keep on churning it out. Because
well, and science is the model for this. Yeah, yeah,
right. Whereas when you go back to the earliest stages of the church's intellectual life, it was bishops and pastors. Take Augustine. His theology was written in sermons. He wasn't producing articles for a small number of elite theologians. He was writing theology for his congregation. And I regret at the moment that someone like you is faced kind of with that choice. It's like, do I go all in with being a professional theologian and scripture scholar, or do I stay close to the people? And have we backed ourselves into a corner here or something?
Maybe it's Stockholm syndrome, but I'm not ready to throw academia under the bus just yet. I think there is a good that is served. There's a very strong good that is served by holding faculty members' feet to the fire and saying, you need to keep up with the literature. You need to keep up with scholarship. You need to demonstrate that you have something to say yourself. I actually appreciated that aspect of it. Although, like I said, I work very slowly at these things. Dan Harrington used to write a book before breakfast every day. Like, that just not the speed at which I can work. So in that sense, you know, I mean, I regret that I didn't have the kind of workflow habit that would allow me to do this. I think you're right. I think your intuition is good that something isn't working well now in the way the church has engaged the intellectual apostolate through universities.
And also, I mean, you could also say that, well, if theologians are constantly have to be reading and writing, well, then are they also out of touch a little bit with the lives of people?
I think that's always a possibility. Yeah.
And the life of the church. I suppose, look, contextual theology, I suppose, is trying to answer that question.
I have some disappointment, but not pessimism in that regard.
I think it's really praiseworthy and admirable that you change direction. It's often really hard just to change and to bring one chapter of your life to an end and move into another one. So I'm glad to hear that you're able to make that decision in peace and in freedom.
Yeah, thank you. It took some doing. I won't deny it. There were there were a few days that were not great, but on a whole, I landed well too. I mean, Chicago is a lovely city and the work I'm doing is a lot of fun. So
tell us what you're doing now.
I'm parish priest at Old St. Patrick's. It's a very large, very vibrant church right downtown, about two blocks west of the Sears Tower. That's usually the only thing non-Americans know about Chicago is the Sears Tower, because it was the tallest building in the world for a while. It's not anymore. We have a school with 880 students, about two-thirds of whom are Roman Catholic, the other third are not. And so I celebrated a Lunar New Year service a couple of weeks ago, and I led a Yom Kippur service in the fall, and I'm also doing the first confessions for the second graders on Saturday. So they keep us busy.
What's the Lunar New Year? Please enlighten me.
People from East Asia, China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, celebrate a cultural, like a civic New Year with the first full moon of January. And boy, is it a fun party. I'm partial to Chinese food, as you know. So I enjoyed myself thoroughly all weekend.
Any parishioners of Old St. Pat's out there will work for food.
But well, for sure.
Yeah.
And then I'm also doing some editing work for America Magazine. I'm a contributing editor for America Magazine remotely, although I go to New York every couple of months. Yeah, but that's mostly, I do some writing for America too, but mostly editing.
Well, it sounds like you had quite the 9 months here in Ireland.
Changed my life. Yeah.
Amazing.
Climbing Skellig Michael.
Let's finish on that.
We're running out of time and I got to get to a meeting, but that was the literal high point of my time in Ireland. Yeah.
Okay. So Skellig Michael. So that's the island outcrop off the coast of Kerry where Celtic monks lived and somehow survived. And also Star Wars was filmed there.
Also true. Yeah.
So you climbed it and made it to the top.
I did.
I've never been there, but I'm planning a young adult parish excursion there. Maybe a little pilgrimage to Skellig Michael in April, May. I think we'll sign off with that, Michael. It doesn't get more Irish Catholic than praying on Skellig Michael. Yeah, that's for sure. Here, listen, it was really good to talk to you, Michael.
Thanks
for coming on to the podcast. And we might get you on again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely.
Okay. Michael,
all right, my
take
friend.
care. God bless.